Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us.
We were in panic mode.
We don't really know what the year is going to look like.
We're going to have to figure out how to get some of those students internet, you know, because some of them live in places where they can't get internet.
It's a lot of stress on a teacher that really cares about her students.
Public school teachers we've heard from as they struggle to do their important work while confronted by all of the new challenges and difficulties brought on by the coronavirus pandemic. One of those voices was that of Holly Robinson, a social studies teacher at Rockcastle County High. We're returning to Rockcastle County for the first in a series of conversations between Tanya May from EKU's College of Education and a selection of school district superintendents from Mount Vernon to Louisville.
We are here with Superintendent Carrie Ballinger of the Rockcastle County School System. Thank you for joining us today, Superintendent Ballinger, and for being a part of our Reopening Kentucky School series.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited and honored to get the opportunity to share with you about Rockcastle County Schools and share with you a little bit about our reopening plans.
Great. Would you begin by just sharing some general information about your district for our listeners who may not be familiar with Rockcastle County?
Yes, we are located right at the edge of southeastern Kentucky. We're located on the I-75 corridor. We have a student population of roughly 2,600 students. We have three elementary schools, one middle school, and one high school. And we also have an area technology center, as well as the Rockcastle County Academy for students. So, fairly small district, located right at the edge of southeastern Kentucky.
Well, we know that all of Kentucky's school districts have been working diligently over the past several months to create a reopening plan that prioritizes both the academic and physical well-being of all of their students. Can you begin by telling us what were some of the most significant challenges your district faced in creating a reopening plan?
Yes. I think the most significant challenge that Rockcastle County Schools has faced has been trying to develop reopening plans during an ever-changing situation. So COVID-19 is unpredictable. The effects of COVID-19 have been unpredictable, thereby making it very difficult to communicate effectively with our staff and our families and our community as to exactly what school will look like this fall. And we have developed four or five what we have felt like have been very solid reopening plans. But then as time would pass, we would receive new guidance or the numbers across the state would begin to spike. And we would have to go back to the drawing table just to reevaluate those plans and tweak those plans to fit the situation that has changed. It's been very much like trying to aim at a moving target on some days. But the key, I think, to this situation for us and to my leadership team and our principals and our staff has just been to maintain a sense of flexibility. And every day we are saying we have to be patient, we have to be flexible, and trying to focus on being positive for our students and our families and our staff, because the key to all of this, although it's changing daily, is we really, really would like to have our kids back in front of us. So that is what we are focusing on. What can we do? If it means we scratch our plan and start all over every single day, what can we do to get our kids back in school?
Yeah. That's very difficult to replace face-to-face instruction.
Yes, it is. In our district, we place high priority on student relationships and knowing our families and knowing their needs. Try to just put a very, very strong emphasis on that. So we need our kids in front of us to be able to accomplish that.
That's very encouraging to hear your district is very relationship-focused with their families and students.
Yes. And I've been so inspired by that from March until right now on August the 5th of just watching how our teachers and our principals and our staff members, our coaches have been phenomenal, how they have maintained contact with our families. And it's not uncommon for me to get a call from a coach or from a teacher or from a staff member saying, this is what's going on in this situation. How can we help? What can we do? And so we've been really tried to focus this whole entire time on rallying behind our families to provide them any needed support that they need.
So, at this point, is your district still considering multiple reopening plans, or do you have one reopening plan that you're moving forward with? And what is your potential reopening date at this point?
We do have multiple reopening plans. We've been spoken to by the governor and Commissioner Brown, and they have recommended that it's necessary to have multiple plans and to be ready to open school with any of those available options. With that being said, though, we are focusing on one plan at this time to provide an online option for our students that we are calling My Rock Online.
Mm-hmm.
And that is for any student or family that's not comfortable at this time coming back to school. So we will be offering that platform as well as offering the traditional platform for students that are ready to return in person. Our start date that our board has approved is August the 26th.
So my understanding then that you're saying you're offering sort of a hybrid plan. There will be face-to-face instruction for families and students who desire that option, and then also there will be an option for remote teaching and learning as well.
Yes, exactly. And through that remote learning, we will be using a platform called Edgenuity, which is an instructional platform that is a virtual learning platform, but every one of our students will be assigned a Rockcastle County school teacher to monitor that learning. So they will have a direct contact with a staff member that they can reach out to at any point for assistance if they have needs. And then as well, we're also going to be using our Family Resource Center directors to be reaching out to those families weekly to maintain connection and to maintain that strong relationship.
With the remote teaching and learning, for the students and families that decide to continue with remote teaching and learning, what type of accommodations will be provided for students who lack access to technological tools they may need or even internet access? How will their needs be met?
Technological tools. We have used our CARES funding monies that we have received, and we have purchased Chromebooks for all of our Rockcastle County school students, kindergarten through 12th grade. So we will be a one-to-one school district. We just felt like it was time, and there was a need for us to eliminate that divide between students that had access to a device and those students that did not. We did not want any student to be in the situation of trying to learn remotely using a phone. You know, it's just not effective, and we felt like that was a commitment that our board made, that we wanted to be able to provide every student a device to use. In addition to that, we recognize that there's some students in our community that do not have access to Wi-Fi. That is a real issue across all of southeastern Kentucky, as you well know. We don't have the answers for that right now. We have put a hotspot on all of our school buildings, so our students would be able to come into the parking lot to have access to Wi-Fi, knowing that that's not ideal. In addition, we're in the process right now of trying to work within our community to potentially work with some of our area churches or volunteer fire departments to provide Wi-Fi in some of those locations across, you know, we have a very rural area, very rural community, so trying to provide services out in the community that parents or students could go to access Wi-Fi. And then we have some situations that we're just working with families individually. I mean, I had a call on Sunday by a grandmother that was concerned about sending her three grandchildren back. She's been going through chemotherapy treatment, you know, had this legitimate health concern, but no access to internet. So we're trying to work with that family and other families similar to that to provide services as needed.
Okay. With your students who will attend face-to-face, will face masks be provided for those students? And will students be, will there be temperature checks, or will students be expected to kind of do those self-health checks before they come, or will that be done on site in the buildings? How will that face-to-face roll out?
Yes, we are encouraging our families to take temperatures before their students either get on the school bus or before they are dropped off at the school building. So we're asking families to take that step before they enter the school. We will be taking temperatures in addition to that. So every student that is a bus rider, they will have their temperature taken prior to exiting the bus to go into their school. If they are coming to school through a parent drop-off, we will be taking temperatures before the parents leave the site, just in case that there is an elevated temperature that we would have the parent there with us. So we're taking temperatures before anyone enters the building. We will be providing, we have ordered personalized face masks for all of our schools, depending on their having their school logo on them. So each student will be provided two school-based logoed masks. Also, we have purchased over 18,000 disposable masks that we will have on hand if a student forgets their mask, doesn't have their mask has dropped, they've left it on the bus. We'll have extras to be able to provide students if needed. And then we're also allowing students to wear their own mask from home if that's the choice. We've done a lot of surveying through all of this of our families to try to determine their needs and wants and wishes and, you know, what they're most comfortable in returning to school. And many families said that they wanted to have their mask custom fit. They wanted, you know, certain, if they had asthma, they had other needs, they wanted to be able to take all of that into consideration. So we are allowing parents to send kids to school in their own mask.
Great. I know being a new superintendent is difficult in any year, no doubt, but can you tell us about some specific or at least one of the important lessons you've learned from being a first-year superintendent in the midst of a pandemic? And how will that make you stronger as a superintendent and actually empower your district moving forward?
Right. Well, you know, I've said several times that this is much like drinking from a fire hose hourly, daily, every minute. But I think the biggest lesson that I have learned from this current situation is the importance of bringing a team together and listening to input and suggestions and ideas and realizing that no one person can operate in a silo during this pandemic and expect success of any form. I think a pandemic is bigger than any one person or anything that I possibly could accomplish on my own. So I've told our leadership team that every day that alone, you know, we're all really smart people, but together, you know, we can do brilliant things, and that it's important for us to continue to work together as a team and to seek input and to listen. One of the most valuable things that we have done is develop task force teams. We developed four task force teams, and those were made up of our administrators, our teachers, our support staff, community members, community leaders, parents, and we also included our Rockkessel County High School student council members in these teams. And listening to their ideas really fueled our reopening plans. Listening, you know, we would think that we were on the right path, and then we would have a task force meeting, and we would think, oh, wow, that's really great information, really good input. We need to take a step back and consider all of these viewpoints. So that to me has been the most important lesson that I've learned, the importance of just listening to others and taking time to be very, very cognizant of the ideas that other people have and trying to support and listen to everybody that's on a team. So,
great.
And it's been a big lesson. And if in my thoughts, if any new superintendent can get through opening school in a pandemic, it's going to make the rest of the years look a lot easier.
I'm sure. Well, it has been so wonderful speaking with you today. I sincerely thank you for your time, and we wish your district much success in the upcoming year. Thank you for joining us.
And thank you for having me.
Coming up after the break, how a true crisis in child care is making a difficult time all the more challenging for working parents.
We're going to have to acknowledge that the workforce involves parents. It involves men and women who have children, and that those children need to be cared for in a safe environment.
And being part of the change you want to see happen in your hometown.
Just because you're from a small town or a low-income area doesn't mean that you can't achieve what other people can. And I think just defeating that self-doubt and getting the confidence and seeing that your success breeds other success, I think that would be my number one piece of advice.
UK engineering student Auburn Mattingly, Lee Todd's guest on the latest in his series, Connecting Dots Between Education and Economic Development. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Support for WEKU and Eastern Standard comes from Hicks and Funson. Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Shannon Church provide legal representation for auto accidents, medical malpractice, elder care, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-522-WEKU. It might be featured on a future show. Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or past episodes? Find them online at weku.org or on the WEKU mobile app. Now, back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
Lexington Herald Leader Government Accountability reporter John Cheeves is here with us to talk about his latest article, Kentucky's Child Care System Was in Decline, Faced with COVID-19, It's Collapsing. Greetings, John.
Hey, Tom. Good to be here.
And first of all, I know you don't like to be part of the story, but am I correct that you and your family are now in a quarantine due to possible exposure?
That's exactly right. Our daughter, who's 3 years old, is in a child care center here in Lexington, and it's a great child care center, but like about 120 others so far since the daycare has reopened in June, they've had somebody who tested positive for COVID. It was her teacher. So her whole class has been quarantined in their homes for 14 days, and out of an abundance of caution, since we've all been exposed to her, we're also quarantined at home. And as Governor Beshear has occasionally updated us in the afternoons, this is becoming more and more common. And it's I'm afraid, the gamble you take when you deal with child care is that the classes have 10 kids in them. They've got teachers in them. And in our communities, COVID is spreading.
Was child care already in trouble before the pandemic brought on these closings?
It was. Ever since the last recession, about 10 years ago, we've seen a decline in the federal and state subsidies that have been provided to poor people to make child care affordable. Child care, as most of your, certainly the parents among your audience know, is really expensive. It can cost $10,000 a year or more for one child in child care. And for a lot of poorer people to be able to afford it, they get subsidies from the government. And these subsidies help sustain the child care system, which is really this patchwork network of private operators all over the state, some nonprofit, some for-profit, almost none of them making very much money. As these public subsidies have been reduced and reduced and reduced, we've seen just since 2013 the number of regulated child care providers in Kentucky steadily drop from more than 4,400 in 2013 to about 2,400 last year. Now we're down, since the three-month shutdown, to about 1,700 child care providers in Kentucky. And of that 1,700, 300-something, about one in five of them is classified as temporarily closed. They haven't reopened since the shutdown from March through June. And, I mean, almost every day we get reports of another one closing either permanently or indefinitely, because they just can't make the money, they can't make the numbers work anymore.
And speaking of not making things work anymore, when these centers close down, it means that people can't go back to work, or at least half of a two-paycheck household is in that situation, right?
That is exactly right. Now, my wife and I are both journalists, and we are very fortunate. We are working from home right now, since the Herald Leader newsroom is basically closed. And it's difficult for us, because with an 11-year-old school-age boy and a 3-year-old preschooler, it's difficult to focus on your jobs while you also have kids at home. There are many people out in Kentucky that don't have a luxury. They have jobs that require them to leave the house and go out and actually work for a living. You can't do that when you've also got to take care of your children. So they have to make a hard decision. Do they keep the job? Do they try to find somebody else to take care of their child? Is it an older relative like a grandparent where now you're risking their health? Do you bring babysitters into the house where now you're bringing other people from the community in and exposing them to your family. You really can't have the economy reopen until you have safe and reliable childcare. The direction we're heading is the opposite of that. We're seeing childcare has disappear. I interviewed one couple for my story in the Sunday Herald Leader. This family, they're on their third childcare of the last 6 months now because each one keeps closing and they hopscotch to the next one and that closes. And of course, that's hugely disruptive to the children too. I mean, 2-, 3-, 4-year-olds, their whole world is this place they go during the day, and they lose all of their friends. They lose their teachers. They don't know what's going on, just that every month or two, everything changes.
Now, in your article, you note that the lack of access has become especially apparent in Perry County. What happened?
We've got sections of the state, and the Pritchard Committee for Academic Excellence has done great research on this, that have become known as child care deserts, where you've got entire counties where there may only be one or two child care options available to you. If they're full, you're out of luck. If they're no good, you're out of luck. And I think the last time I looked at the Pritchard Committee's map, you even had a couple areas like Martin County, Inez, just north of the Pikeville area, where there really weren't any child care options. So if you had kids and you wanted to go to work, good luck to you. And at least in Lexington and Louisville, I mean, we do have competing child cares. They're usually in some place, especially if you can wait a little bit. But increasingly, just like there's food deserts where there's no grocery stores, we're seeing child care deserts where there's no place for parents to get help caring for their young children.
You also write that and point out that where this is happening, especially where these child care center deserts are present, that this is also impeding economic development in the region, that which implies that child care is an investment in infrastructure, I suppose.
Well, it is. And, of course, if you look at some of the more progressive and large employers in the area, like Toyota, many of them offer child care on site. Universities often offer child care on site, both for students and employees. So, I mean, it's long been recognized that if you want to recruit and retain good employees, many of whom are younger and starting their families, the child care is something that's critical to them. Of course, now for the employers, you know, you're having a problem maintaining that because of the safety, the health protocols that are necessary to keep the daycares going. But if people can't take care of their families, they can't get to work. And that's just going to be something we struggle with as we try to, you know, reopen the economy over and over the next year.
Well, going back to those options that you were listing earlier, there seems to be some enthusiasm for reviving in-home child care. And I wonder how that approach would bring some relief to the situation, if it can.
One of the experts I spoke to was a professor, Cindy McGehee, down at Berea College. And she'd mentioned this might be the time to go back to the smaller model of certified child care providers in their homes, people taking care of 4, 5, 6 children in their home, instead of the licensed child care center, like where my daughter is, where you've got dozens of kids in a large building with, you know, a whole staff of teachers. And the advantage to that, of course, is scale. It's easier to sort of keep things on a manageable scale with a half dozen kids. There's less likelihood of infection. And in fact, we just posted on Kentucky.com today, the Herald Leader's website, a story I wrote with a list of about 120 of the child care providers that have been identified with a report of a COVID infection. And out of the 120, I only saw two that are what are called a certified child care home, somebody who basically does this in their house. Most of them were the licensed child care centers, the larger facilities with multiple teachers and multiple classrooms. And it's not that there's anything wrong with the way the centers operate. They're taking precautions. It's just it's a matter of odds. If you've got, you know, 60, 80, 100 kids across 6, 8, 10 rooms, you know, statistically the odds are against you avoiding the virus as the months go on.
You cite Lillian Sims of Lexington as an example of how women are taking on much of the burden when daycare centers close. Tell us about that.
She is a PhD student at the University of Kentucky studying higher education, and she was getting close to finishing her degree. She had about a year to go, finish her dissertation, and then she was going to go start a career in academia. Their daycare closed, Central Baptist daycare in Lexington, and her husband and she made the decision to go ahead and just have her quit her studies for now and stay at home with their children. They've got another baby on the way. She hated to do it because it's going to delay her career for at least a year, if not more. But everyone else, they were at a daycare that was shutting down. And once you get that note from the daycare saying we're closing, suddenly there's 40, 50, 60 families all at once saying, oh my gosh, we need to find another daycare. There's only so many slots, even in a city the size of Lexington. So you can join the scramble for an open slot, or two in their case, because they're going to have two kids, or you can resign yourself to just stay at home. And more often than not, that's the mom, that's the woman. And so as parents have to put their careers second, what that really means usually is the woman puts her career second. It's unfair, but that's the way it works.
Well, John, I'm going to ask you to step away from being a reporter for the moment and just offer your perspective based on your work on this story and ask you, what do you think that the state legislature, the state government, Congress, federal government, what can they do to help child care centers continue offering these services that people need so badly if they're going to work and be productive?
I would argue there needs to be just a radical restructuring of how preschools are funded. You know, K through 12 schools, starting when the kids are about age five, are supported by the taxpayers. We have a State Department of Education, and we have local school districts that support them. But up until the kids are age five, it's olly-olly oxen-free. The daycares have to fend for themselves through, again, this sort of patchwork funding model where some parents like me come up with the $10,000 a year. Other parents have to scramble to find whatever subsidies they can. And you have this wide variety of quality. Some daycares are good, some aren't. Some are going broke, some are doing okay. And that's just unacceptable for something as important as the health and well-being of children, you know, ages 6 months to 5 years. If we have a K through 12 funding model publicly for schools, why not step up at least for 3 and 4 year olds, you know, for the pre-K 1 and pre-K 2 crowd? There needs to be more public support for these institutions. Even if that means putting the government in charge more and getting, you know, the private enterprise out a little bit. It's a huge but worthwhile investment, because the healthier and better off these kids are today, the better citizens they're going to be 20 years from now.
That's Lexington Herald Leader Government Accountability Reporter John Cheese. Thank you so much, John.
Thank you, Tom.
Now, for a closer look at the pandemic's impact on child care, we're going to June Widman, Executive Director of the Appalachian Early Childhood Network based in Berea. Thanks for joining us, June.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And as we've heard, John Cheese of the Herald Leader has provided an overview of the status of child care across Kentucky in this pandemic. And I'd like to ask you if you could tell us what you are seeing happen in the eastern region that the coalition represents and serves.
Sure. I think it's important, Tom, to note that before the pandemic, there were already issues with child care availability in the region that maybe were not the case in some other places in the more urban areas of our state. So we already had folks kind of, you know, scrambling to find good quality child care or to find any kind of regulated care available to them. And so the pandemic only increased the difficulty that people had and made it, you know, in some places nearly impossible, even though child care providers were allowed to start back up. If they weren't there to begin with, it's not going to do much good.
Are there a particular, for lack of a better word, hotspots in the region that are in particular need for child care under these circumstances?
So when things first became an issue in March, as far as, you know, child care programs shutting down, folks that were considered first responders, the hospital personnel, that kind of thing, you know, which is important throughout the region, they were scrambling to see what they could do. And so a few programs stepped up and said, we'll stay open, tell us how to do this, and we'll do it accordingly. And so if you look at it, especially the Appalachian region where hospitals are located, those would be areas that were in the most need that, you know, found a way to provide care for families that had to keep working. you know, when you look at the lay of the land and you think about what it takes just from a business model aspect to be able to provide good quality care, there's a cost factor that folks will generally agree has to do with a base number of how many clients do I need to make this business viable, right? And when you look at the way the population is in Eastern Kentucky, where it's so spread out that it's hard to get a concentrated number of folks to be able to open a center serving 100 kids, you know, to be able to make it financially. And so what you've got is throughout the entire region, a real difficulty in having enough of a workforce available to keep good programs open and running.
And June, I'm wondering if you can give us an example of how this situation is causing a real hardship for a typical working family.
Sure. So many of the jobs that people have are not the kind that could easily switch over to a work from home model. So many folks employed in the service industry who had to keep working, fast food places, grocery stores, all those kinds of things. And so when childcare shut down completely, those folks were not considered essential workers, were really on their own to, you know, figure out what to do to still go to their job, to put, you know, themselves at risk, and yet adequate and safe place for their children to be. When family child care providers were allowed to open back up in the first part of June, again, it's that whole issue of, in our region, we have so few that while that's a great answer, it keeps a small group of kids together, kind of lessens the impact of the possibility of spreading the virus. But again, if they weren't there to start with, it doesn't help. And so, unfortunately, in our region, so much child care has ended up coming under the radar, being unregulated, being a fragile system of family and neighbors and friends kind of pitching in when they can. All of that doesn't lead to a very stable situation for the workforce. So the impact is pretty great.
What about in-home care? Is that a realistic alternative? And if it is it adequately supported with state and federal funding?
Our belief, organizationally and just from, you know, looking at it from a practical end of things as well, is that it really is a very viable situation, because originally the legislation around creating small family child care homes as a certified business was to say that when you're just caring for a fewer number of children in a home environment, there is less regulation that's necessary. You still want to assure safety and health of the children and that people are providing adequate activities and oversight of the children, but it doesn't quite take all the legislation or all the rules and regulations that a larger program with a lot more impact in terms of numbers of children would have. When legislation first passed to create small family child care homes, there was a lot of state support around seeing that happen. There were folks whose job it was to just focus on family child care. There were incentives to help if the person needed to build a fence or if they needed a little startup funds because of having to get more insurance or whatever the business costs were for starting up. And so at one time in the early part of 2000, we had over 1,200 small family certified homes across the Commonwealth. And then, you know, kind of one reason and another, that number started to decline and then took a real hit to where just before the pandemic had its impact, there were less than 250 of those homes across the Commonwealth. We saw a great decline in Eastern Kentucky to where in the heart of our Appalachian counties, there's a handful instead of what could really be a good viable business model for childcare in that area, serving, you know, communities that wouldn't necessarily have the reach of a larger center.
Well, I think it's safe to say at this point that if there is anything certain about coronavirus, it's the uncertainty and the unpredictability that it engenders. And so I'm wondering about how is that, and how about the COVID precautionary rules that we're now living under, making things even more difficult for parents who are trying to size up child care centers to make sure that they're right for their kids?
Sure. The centers themselves are under rules and guidance that came out of the CDC, and they make a lot of sense. The objective is to keep group sizes small so that if there is somebody, testing positive, instead of, say, a staff person that maybe typically would be throughout a center in the day, kind of moving from, giving breaks to people, whatever, one room to the next, if that person was positive, they could impact 100 kids. But instead, by trying to keep staff with a group of 10 kids, the likelihood of having to shut down the entire program versus a classroom, it makes sense. So along with the very strict rules about taking temperatures throughout the day, kids over 5 wearing masks. I mean, there's just really a whole lot of precautions that have gone into trying to make it a safe alternative for those that really have no other choice. If they're going to work, their children have to be cared for by someone. The issue there, Tom, is that all of that translates into a higher expense on the part of the program, and parents can't shoulder that burden. The state has stepped up and offered some help for the time being, but it isn't sustainable. And so unless there is an infusion of a lot more funding into the system, it really is going to fall apart.
Well, that takes me straight to the next question, which is more general in nature and not necessarily tied to the pandemic that we're in now. And that is, why is childcare important in economic development of a region?
I think having the perspective of working in this area for many years, I've seen childcare more from an economic development issue to an education issue, and then back again and back again. But I think if we think about it as part of the infrastructure that's necessary for any community to sustain any kind of viable economic growth, we're going to have to acknowledge that the workforce involves parents, it involves men and women who have children, and that those children need to be cared for in a safe environment. And so, just like an industrial park wouldn't think about opening unless they had adequate electricity and water and sewer and roads, those things that we typically think of with infrastructure, the folks who work on that kind of thing never really thought about, and unless there is adequate childcare, as a workforce support, it's just not going to happen. So childcare really is a part of that. And I think in part because it has fallen on women for the most part to figure it out, to find how, who can care for my child while I go to work. And they have found other women who have been willing to do it for really low wages. It's just something that's kind of, we've just moved along and not seen the attention drawn to it that it needs in order to end up with a viable and long-lasting means of caring for our very important children who, need to be treated for what they are, which is the importance of families today and the importance of our workforce and our future for tomorrow.
June Widman, Executive Director of the Appalachian Early Childhood Network in Berea. Thank you so much, June.
Thank you, Tom.
We've been talking about the connection between the availability of childcare services and economic development. Well, something else that is a key to growing local businesses and attracting employers is the focus of an Eastern Standard series hosted by former UK President Lee Todd.
Today I'm talking to Auburn Mattingly, a student at the University of Kentucky in the College of Engineering. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Auburn.
Thank you, Dr. Todd. I'm glad to be here.
Well, tell us a little bit about yourself. You know, where are you from? Where did you go to high school? And what are you doing now?
Well, I grew up in Lincoln County, and I was born and raised there. I'm from a little town called Houstonville, Kentucky. I grew up playing soccer. I traveled and played select soccer, and so that took up a lot of my time through elementary and middle school. In high school, whenever I was introduced to Advanced Kentucky in AP classes, I started focusing more on my schoolwork, and that's where I really found my love of math and science. And I now attend the University of Kentucky, and I'm majoring in civil engineering.
We know this interview series was initiated to highlight the connection between education, early education in particular, and economic development, with an emphasis on entrepreneurship. And your young career is a perfect example of how the education system makes that connection happen. So tell us about your high school experience with Advanced Kentucky, which was the subject of our previous broadcast.
Yeah, I would love to. So I'm going to start with an AP class, because in middle school, I really did not know what an AP class was. So an AP class allows high school students to get credit, college credit, for a class that they're taking at their high school. So they stay at the high school teacher teaches it, but at the end of the year, they take a test, and if they score 3, 4, or 5, then they get college credit for that. Advanced Kentucky really gives you the materials and the resources you need to be successful. So that was really powerful for me, because not only did they provide the teaching resources and help teachers, as you heard from Ms. Cox, who taught my AP biology class in a previous session, they also provided economic development. So for low-income areas, they actually covered the cost of the AP exam, and that was a huge burden lifted off of my shoulders. And then if you passed the exam, you also got $100. So those things, you know, especially to a high school student, being able to pass an exam and get that reward was a motivation factor. But for me, it really helped with confidence. So I mentioned earlier how I really focused on soccer in middle school, but in high school, I kind of turned more to academics. And what really started that and spearheaded that was Advanced Kentucky and AP classes. So in middle school, I really, you know, got all A's, was a hard worker, but I didn't really put forth effort or see myself as someone who was special or could achieve high-level things.
Mm-hmm.
But through my AP class, I studied really hard, and my first exam was AP Environmental Science. I remember getting my scores back, and I checked out the scores online, and it said score 5, and I didn't believe it. I thought that that was possible score. And so I showed my mom, and she's like, no, I think that's your actual score. So I actually had to print out the paper to believe that I scored a 5.
Mm-hmm.
And seeing that I could be in the top percentage of students and score that well on an AP exam is really what showed me that I could compete and that gave me the confidence to keep going. It was really a springboard. And so from that, I ended up taking multiple AP classes, attended Saturday study sessions with Advanced Kentucky, used all their resources, and I ended up getting 60 hours of college credit. I
Wow.
was named a National Merit Finalist, and to this day, that first AP exam, my APES, that's what we called AP Environmental Science, mm-hmm. my class, getting a 5 on that is still my biggest accomplishment, because it's what gave me the confidence I needed to succeed.
Boy, that's quite a springboard, I'd have to say. Well, you know, you obviously had the confidence because you chose one of the toughest college majors to go into engineering. And you've obviously done well, because the first time I met you was in that Dean's Leadership class. And it's very competitive to be selected for that class. They only take 18 students out of 2,000 junior and seniors each year. And so I heard your story about the impact AP had on you and Advanced Kentucky in particular. But now, in addition to your classwork, you've done some internships with some companies outside of the university. Tell us about those experiences.
Yeah, for sure. So my first internship was with AGE Engineering. That's located in Stamford, Kentucky. And I actually worked there through high school, throughout the school day, and then my summer after my senior year. So they did a lot of land surveying and project development, and also got to learn about entrepreneurship, because Doug Gooch started that company from the ground up. So mm-hmm. I love being able to pick his brain about that. My second internship was with the Kentucky Transportation Cabinet, and I worked in bridge preservation and maintenance. So I was really able to apply stuff that I'd learned in my classes, like statics and solids, to load ratings of the bridges and see why there was a 2-ton rating or how we did the structural analysis. So that was really cool. And then my third internship was with Collins Engineers, and that was last summer, and I did underwater bridge inspection. So you actually use a piece of sonar equipment, and it sends out sound waves and frequencies, and from that, you're able to create an image of what the bridge looks like underwater. So that was really cool to see, like, oh, there's a crack here, and this needs repair, because you can really see how the engineering principles help to keep people safe in the real world. And this summer, I'm working at Lockheed Martin. I'm in the aeroscience department, and I'm doing analysis.
You know, I would like for our audience just to reflect for a moment about this young child playing soccer early in life and now having worked for some of the top companies in the summertime and being able to articulate some of the things that you've learned and seen at still a very young age. It's a transformational experience that being exposed to these tough subjects and building your confidence allows you to get into running that you might not have otherwise been able to do. But I have a feeling you've been successful at anything you did. In addition to the things you've mentioned, you're also involved in recruiting other women in engineering through the Society for Women Engineers. So I admire that effort you're putting. You're paying back some at that point. So tell us what that Society for Women Engineers does with these young girls.
Yes, definitely. So I had some mentors growing up, like Aaron Van Zee, who worked at the Transportation Cabinet, who really had an impact on me in wanting to pursue engineering. Just like Advanced Kentucky helped me gain confidence, those mentors were so important to showing me that I could do engineering. So that's why I love being able to give back. With the Society of Women Engineers, at UK, we have over 250 members now, which is a number we're really proud of. And my job with the Society of Women Engineers is outreach director. So that includes not only recruiting high school girls to choose engineering as their major, but also introducing elementary school girls to engineering and showing them that whenever they're doing math and science or creating problem solving, that they're doing engineering and just opening that doorway for them. So I did Lunch with SWE, which was a weekly lunch with high school girls touring the college engineering, and we really sat down with them, the SWE volunteers, and talked to them about our experience in engineering and showed them that we were succeeding, how we enjoyed it, and how that this was something that they could do too, that it wasn't too hard for them, that they had the confidence and capability to do it. We had over 113 people attend the Society of Women Engineers luncheon that included 53 girls and 60 guests of their family. So we were able to make an impact on those girls, and it's so neat to see now as a peer mentor for UK, a bunch of them are attending UK for their freshman year and say that that lunch had an impact on their decision to attend UK.
Oh, that's super. And when I taught at UK, I think there were two women in engineering and chemical engineering, and that was it. So to have 250 involved is important, but also to show these other young students who are trying to make up their minds and their parents that you all are succeeding is just powerful, and that's just a great contribution. Another thing that you've done is to look into entrepreneurship with some of the coursework that you've done, and that's such an important thing we need to do in this state is to have our students to start their own companies, to think about working with startup companies. I used to say when I came back from graduate school and the students at UK would ask me, what are some differences between MIT and UK? I'd say, for one thing, you walk through the student lounge on Monday morning, they're not talking about basketball. You know, they're talking about moving the world. But secondly, they didn't go to MIT expecting to work for somebody else all their lives. I said, you all want to go to college and get a job. They want to go to college and create jobs. And you've chosen the entrepreneurship emphasis. But how did you do that at UK? What course track did you take?
Yeah, so I am in the Scholars in Engineering and Management program. So that is a combination between engineering and business. And through that coursework, I've been able to take classes such as entrepreneurship, learning about marketing, accounting. And it really is the best of both worlds because you get to combine that engineering mindset and the business side of entrepreneurship. I applied for that program because I had worked at AG Engineering with Doug Gooch and saw how he started that company from the ground up. And entrepreneurship was really interesting to me from that. I once read a quote that said that education is the most powerful weapon you can use to change the world, by Nelson Mandela. And I just thought that that fit it so perfectly because it opened so many doors. So one of the classes was with Randall Stevens. He's actually an entrepreneur himself, has started many companies. And we were able to, through the whole semester, just pick his brain about how he started these companies, you know, like the ups and the downs, you know, because it's not all like roses, you know. Yes. And just learn from him. And that was one of my favorite classes at UK, because not only did he share his experience, but he also brought in different entrepreneurs to talk to us as well from different business areas and sectors.
Well, you know, I do believe that one of the things that Kentucky has got to do in order to be competitive is to have our own companies start here. Kentucky companies started by Kentuckians will stay in Kentucky. And you got to start thinking about entrepreneurship early on. And being exposed to people like Randall, who I've known for many years, is just very powerful. What would you say to young college students that are considering what they want to do now, or even high school students? How could they make choices with respect to something like Advance Kentucky?
I would say to dream big and to take advantage of all the opportunities, because Advance Kentucky provided the resources, and it was up to me to use those to study for my AP exams, to go to the Saturday sessions. And by using those resources, you never know what you're going to achieve. And so don't put a limit or a cap on yourself. Just because you're from a small town or a low-income area doesn't mean that you can't achieve what other people can. And I think just defeating that self-doubt and getting the confidence and seeing that your success breeds other success, I think that would be my number one piece of advice.
That's wonderful. Well, Auburn, thank you for telling your story. Congratulations on your outstanding accomplishments to date. I've been talking to Auburn Mattingly, an engineering student that is an excellent role model for other Kentucky students. Thank you so much, Auburn.
Thank you, Dr. Todd.
You can find Dr. Todd's previous interviews on our site. Go to esweku.org, click on the series tab, and you'll find it right there in the drop-down menu. That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard online at weku.org or esweku.org, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. We'd like to hear from you. You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.